Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rosendahl, the host of Marketplace, public radio show on business and economics.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we try to get a little smarter each week about business and culture and technology, you know, smart stuff.
But it is not just us. We've got you out there. You tell us the things you want to learn more about. You share with us the things you know more about than anybody else, because as we say when we're sitting around the coffee table, you know, having a snack or something, none of us is as smart as all of us.
We say that all the time. We really do. I just sit around thinking it's like a mantra.
That's right. So we talked, was it last week, a couple of weeks ago? We've talked about it a couple of times, about Uber and how reputation matters.
Exactly. So we decided to call up Lyft and see how they were feeling about the reputation situation happening all around them. So I popped down to their offices in San Francisco, talked with John Zimmer, the co-founder and president at Lyft, which of course is Uber's main competitor. It was really nice.
It was very nice. It was a nice little interview. There is, however, a word you are not going to hear Mr. Zimmer say. I will give you three guesses. Starts with a U and ends with an R. But he is going to answer our Make Me Smart question at the end of the show.
He is. But before all of that, you know we have to get our fix. The news fix is what I mean. We affectionately refer to it as the fix, and it is the part of the show where we talk about the things that are happening in the news that either matter to us or seem to have a larger thread that we can pull. All right, so in our Facebook Live editorial meeting on Monday, if you don't know about those, by the way, please keep an eye on our Twitter. We do a Facebook Live video on Mondays. We actually did one on Friday, too, just as a sort of mini episode. To kind of talk over ideas, talk about stories that we're interested in, find out stories you might be interested in, read your comments. And overwhelmingly in the comments yesterday in our Facebook Live video, all anybody wanted to know about was immigration, which obviously makes sense because it's kind of in the news. So specifically, the questions were about the new executive order signed by President Trump this week.
There's a lot detail-wise to know about, right? Doesn't go into effect right away. It's the 16th of March. Iraq was removed from the list. There are six countries now, seven. If you have a current valid visa, you're not affected. There's nobody going to be, in theory anyway, sitting in an airport or getting turned around. Mm-hmm. Refugees already granted asylum will be allowed, but refugee processing has been halted for 120 days. Lots of new stuff in there. The old one was specifically revoked. But it gets us to what I believe is the theme of the broadcast today, which is the law of intended consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we've been talking a lot on this show about unintended consequences.
Right.
But Kai, you're absolutely right. This is now what happens when this is, in fact, the better thought through plan that was clearly enacted with the help of actual lawyers. And now what do we see? And one of the things we see is apparently an actual plan to potentially, and Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly confirmed that this week, to potentially separate children from their parents at the border, not just as a matter of deportation, but as an effort at deterrence.
All right, so here it is. It's you're going to hear Wolf Blitzer first. This is Monday on CNN talking to the Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly, talking about the very big picture immigration policy of the Trump administration.
If you get some young kids who are coming in, managed to sneak into the United States with their parents, are Department of Homeland Security personnel going to separate the children from their moms and dads?
We have tremendous experience in dealing with unaccompanied minors. We turn them over to HHS, and they do a very, very good job of either putting them in kind of foster care or linking them up with parents or family members in the United States. Yes, I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents.
But you understand how that looks to the average person who is...
It's more important to me, Wolf, to try to keep people off of this awful network.
So granted that it's a terrible experience to be coming across that border and to be subject to the whims of the coyotes, the smugglers, and all of that. But I'm not actually sure that Secretary Kelly and the Trump administration understand how this policy is going to play.
Yeah,
that's just my two cents.
I mean, look, we have seen this sort of throughout. We have seen the argument be that the danger is more important than anything else. And so now we find out how the American people feel about the ends actually justifying the means. And the idea of separating children from their parents as a deterrent is, it's hard to interpret that as anything other than cruelty. deliberate cruelty to keep people from wanting to come here. And if you stipulate that most of the people who are trying to emigrate to the United States are doing so because conditions in their home countries are not ideal, all the way to horrifically dangerous, it becomes a tough argument to make.
Yeah, except for this, right? And let me just do the whole devil's advocate flip side of the coin thing, right? I mean, Kelly's job is Homeland Security, and his job is to not let people who shouldn't be here in, and that has been interpreted by the Trump administration, and they won, so they get to decide as not letting illegal immigrants come in through the border.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, maybe he's right. Maybe parents who are thinking about bringing their child or their children or whatever are going to say, you know what, now I'm not going to go.
Oh, it could absolutely be a deterrent.
Right,
yes.
And it rings terribly callously, but this is going to sound callous as well. Maybe they don't care how it looks. They just want the results.
Well, I think that's clearly the case.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Other intended consequences, and this was a really interesting story that Kai found, actually, in the Daily Beast, how the ban could make airports even worse because it insists upon something that's been in the works for a while, actually, full implementation of a biometric entry and exit system. So fingerprints, possibly down the road, retina scans that have not yet been implemented, partly because it takes a really long time and they're really expensive and it's really hard to do. And so that may start to come into effect, but in probably a willy-nilly way.
Well, yeah, probably
which will make
be,
airport but, lines even worse. You
right,
know?
But so once again, and here I am defending the administration. We do not have, if you travel almost anywhere else in the world, right, you get two cards on the way in. One is the information card that you hand in when you cross customs. And then the other one is that card that you have to hold on to that you turn in on the way out. Oh, look, there's Molly's dog.
I know.
Hey, man, let's bring the dog in. But and you have to turn that in so that the government of the country in question can know who comes in and who leaves. We don't have exit controls in this country. The law has been on the books for a long time, but it's crazy hard to put this stuff into a system that does not have it baked in from the beginning, right? And so now, with the new executive order that came out yesterday, there's a renewed emphasis on exit controls for border crossings on the way out. So that means you're going to have to queue up on the way out. They're saying biometrics, so it's retinal scans or fingerprints, whatever it is, and do this. And now you have to leave like 4 hours to get your plane instead of the 2 hours it is now.
Not to mention sort of the added burden on TSA. There's new conversations today about enhanced and more intimate pat downs. So, you know, trickle effect. One other possible trickle effect before we even get to sort of the larger economic questions about immigration, which are the things we talked about in the Facebook Live. For example, in Texas, there's a story today in the Houston Chronicle about how about one in three of the doctors in rural Texas are foreign-born or immigrants. And so as the policies on immigration extend past, you know, this particular ban and these six countries and into, as this administration has signaled, into restricting and reducing legal immigration, you could really start to see an immediate impact on things like doctors in rural areas, things like the tech industry, which we've talked about over and over. Just and as I keep bringing up, the president's own goals around growth, which are going to be hard to accomplish without legal immigration.
Exactly, which totally gets us to the next thing, which is what a lot of your questions were about, which is how is this going to affect the economy? And here's the deal. So there's studies out the wazoo on this, of course, right? And you can get right-leaning and left-leaning economists, and they will say diametrically opposed things. We went to the George Bush Institute, or the Bush Center, rather, and looked up some stuff from an economist there. And so, first of all, let's lay the groundwork, right? And by the way, when I say the Bush Institute or the Bush Center, it's George W. Bush, obviously.
Yep.
So here is the immigration baseline. From 2009 to 2014, there were negative 140,000 net migrants to this country from Mexico. So the Great Recession, as we have said on Marketplace on the Air many times in the past, the Great Recession did a lot of what the Trump administration is trying to do now, right? We are not getting new illegal immigrants in from Mexico. That's just a fact.
It's not happening. And deportations, so to the argument that immigration is not being enforced, deportations were at various points during the Obama administration at an all-time high.
Right.
But now, when you then get back to the economy, it is a fact that immigration fuels the economy. immigrants increase the, this directly from this BushCenter.org report, increase the productive capacity of the economy, raise GDP. It's called an immigration surplus. They're more likely to move for jobs than native, you know, quote unquote, native workers, which helps relieve bottlenecks to expansion. They overall tend to lead to it, an increase in high-skilled immigration, which is what the tech industry has been argued for, is linked to innovation, higher patenting rates. I mean, it sort of goes on and on in terms of the economic benefits that are undeniable. But the fact is that this country, pretty much since its inception, has had a very complicated emotional reaction to immigration that is just sort of ping-ponged back and forth.
Yep.
Since the 1600s, we were kicking people out of this country in the 1600s for not, quote unquote, fitting in. That's according to a book called Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America by Peter Schrag.
We'll look it up in our book club.
Go look it up. Go look it up. It's fascinating. Literally the year 1637 is the first time that they have a record of someone being expelled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony because she was not sufficiently respectful of ministerial establishment in Massachusetts at the time.
How awesome is it that I learned something on my own podcast called Make Me Sorry?
See?
I love that. I love that.
It's amazing. But yeah, look, so the idea of quotas, you know, doesn't come into place until the 1920s. I mean, I learned so much about this, which is the goal, right? Learn a bunch,
right.
Pass it on. But even though we talk about ourselves as a nation of immigrants, there's no question that this country in particular has a really complicated relationship with deciding who we're okay with.
Totally does. Last thing on this Bush Center report, and then I guess we probably ought to move on. It's also true that, at least in the initial stages, immigrant labor lowers the wages of workers here. But it lowers wages of previous immigrants more than it does of natives, right? So the previous immigrants are the ones who suffer. And also, she points out, the Economist wrote this paper does, that most of the gains, which is a truism, whether you're talking about immigration or not, or any other part of this economy, most of the gains go to the holders of capital, right? Most of the gains go to the owners. They go to the people who run the businesses, all of that stuff. It doesn't actually go to everybody, which is part of the problem of why we are so emotionally vested in immigration in this country to begin with.
One other interesting nugget, and then I swear I'm going to let us move on, comes in answer, partly an answer to a question from John Steffer, who said, if we are so supposedly so upset about immigrants taking, illegal immigrants taking our jobs, why doesn't the federal government investigate, raid, and punish the U.S. employers who hire them? And that is something that John Schrag brought up in an interview with a public radio station about the fact that our enforcement always focuses on borders, which is just a sort of a revolving door, and could arguably much more effectively focus on the labor part.
Yeah.
So just throwing that out there as a possible answer.
Yeah, so that's the takeaway, right? I mean, all of those things are happening on purpose. That is and was the plan of this administration. And we should just, as all of this stuff rolls out, we should just bear that in mind.
Oh, yeah. Immigration was a huge part of the campaign. Even though, you know, people at the Bush Foundation and elsewhere said, hey, it's really gone down and it, we're not sure why it's such a big focus. The fact is that it is, and we can expect this to continue. And it gets to a sort of a larger question about immigration in this country. Yes, we said we've been ping-ponging back and forth since the 1600s, but also with Congress essentially unable to agree on what to do about immigration and this sort of national ambivalence, what keeps happening is executive orders. So the ping-pong is not likely, I guess, to go away in the short term.
Totally true. So one of the things we do on this podcast, as you guys know, is take your questions and find out answers. There were so many questions yesterday about immigration and about this new executive order and what's going to happen. We're going to consolidate. And it all boils down to something that William Pottinger asked us online. He said, what are the economic impacts of the administration's proposed immigration policy? That's a very large question, right? And we're going to keep on going with this.
And we will continue to explore it, look for follow-up blog posts, look for stories on Marketplace about it, because it's obviously a huge deal. But please keep letting us know what you think. Let us know your personal experiences. Feel free to record yourself.
Oh, yeah.
We love to get your audio and play it on the show. Just hit the little voice memo on your iPhone or your voice recording app on your Android. Give us like 30 seconds or a minute. Anything bigger than that, and you're not going to be able to email it. And then email it to makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can actually just make it really simple. Go to our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart, and write us a little note.
Coming up next, the co-founder and president of Lyft. His name is John Zimmer. Do, 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 do. talked about Uber last week, and Molly brought up the very good question of, wait, there's this company called Lyft.
What are they doing? Because Lyft had a PR coup early on after the implementation of the first immigration ban. And so we said, okay, what are they going to do now? We called them up. Turns out they're in downtown San Francisco. So we went to their offices. I had a nice long conversation with John Zimmer, asked him all kinds of questions about Uber and Lyft, mostly Lyft. And here was some new information. And we're going to play that clip right off the top before we get to the full interview. You know, there are reports this week that you're seeking another $500 million investment. It seems like growing this business is very expensive. Is it economically viable? I mean, are you locked in a subsidy war at this point that just means you need more and more and more and more cash?
No. So, yes, it is economically viable. And we are on a path to profitability. We've talked about being profitable next year. We feel very confident in that. We even think there's the likely scenario that we will be the first U.S. rideshare player to be profitable. And part of that is because of our focus on the United States, where you do have per ride a positive unit economics. And at a certain scale, that margin pays for the marketing costs as well as the overhead of having a team. And we feel like we will cross that. We're confident we'll cross that next year.
All right, so wait, I have to climb in here. I was listening to the preview version of this interview, the rough cut, last night as I was making dinner in the kitchen. And I heard that bit about we're going to be the first to ride-sharing service in the United States to become profitable and all this jazz. And honestly, I cussed out loud in my kitchen because that is just hooey. There's no way. They're losing, what, $500 million to $700 million a year, the best guesses are.
In 2016, yeah.
I mean, you have got to be kidding me that he actually believes that. That's a technical economic journalism term.
I was going to say, is that like a, well, can we make that into a sting? Because we need to use that in future shows forever. Forever. I was very, very surprised to hear that because of the amount of money that both of these companies have been pouring into growth. However, Uber has poured billions of dollars into China in particular. Yes. They spent so much money in China. They have spent so much money on global expansion, and Lyft has been the slow and steady, which I think
it's like that
is
cartoon.
Much,
sorry.
It's like they're like the little turtle.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's like that Bugs Bunny cartoon back from when I was a kid on Saturday mornings, and you got Bugs Bunny running, and you got the turtle going, ba-dum, 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 dum. Right? Come on.
Yep, exactly. And trust me, right now, when you hear the rest of the interview, it is only going to cement that impact, that impression. All right, roll it. We're in the Wonka room. I need to know what the deal is with the Wonka room and why there's a picture that I can walk through. I hear there's some backstory here.
So when I was a little kid, my favorite movie was Willy Wonka or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
And I just love the magic and excitement that the movie and Wonka put behind chocolate. And we're trying to bring that to transportation.
All right. I'm going to start with the sort of obvious thing, which is that your primary competitor, Uber, is stuck right now in a series of, pardon the pun, road bumps, big ones. You're being handed potentially an opportunity of biblical proportions. What do you do? What are you doing to capitalize?
We keep doing the thing we've always been doing, which is be true to Lyft's values, be true to who we are, and take care of our customers, take care of our drivers better than any other company. And that's been our philosophy for a really long time. It's paying off now. It's paid off over the last several years. Lyft is growing faster than the competition and has been. And we'll just keep doing that, taking care of our drivers and passengers.
And is that do you feel like you just can be quiet about it? You don't need to come out and say, you know, we're the better option?
I don't think we specifically need to comment on our competitor. I think we should make sure people know who we are. People should know what we stand for. And people should know that we really care about giving them an amazing experience.
Talk about those corporate values, if you would, for the people who don't know.
Sure. So one of the internal values is be yourself. We really want people to come to work, to feel comfortable, to feel safe being themselves. We think that leads to greater productivity. We think that leads to building a better product for a diverse community of people that are using our services. If you have an opinion that you don't think is shared by us, the leadership, or hasn't been represented, that you speak up and let us know about it. And we reward that. We let people know when they tell us something that is different than how we were thinking about it, that we really appreciate it. And we often put many of those suggestions into practice.
And then how do those corporate values trickle down to the driver? I mean, I know, you know, when Lyft started, it was totally the mustache and the fist bump. You did the fist bump with our engineer. And then it seemed like you backed away from that a little bit. Some of the marketing message changed, or it wasn't as strongly about getting in the car with a friend. How are you now trying to sort of communicate those values to the drivers, many of whom drive for both services?
Yeah, Lyft, you got to remember when Lyft started almost 5 years ago now, that the idea of getting in someone else's car was very new and very different and what many would say strange. When we told people what we were going to do 5 years ago, people said there's no way anyone's going to be okay with that. From the beginning, we made safety the most important thing we do. That allows people to have trust, open themselves up. And then because this was a new behavior we wanted to change, we suggested people in the early days sat up front and did a fist bump. That's no longer required or anything that we put pressure on doing. In fact, a lot of people are now sitting in the back and quietly listening to music or something like that, which is totally fine. But it set the stage for an experience of respect. And we've seen that turn into drivers and passengers doing great things for each other. There's stories of a driver hearing a passenger say that they hadn't eaten lunch and that driver showing up to their meeting with a sandwich just to do something nice, and passengers bringing coffee for their drivers and small things like that that remind both the Lyft community and a broader community that humanity can be really good when we take care of each other.
Do you think that is... like one of the things I'm fascinated with on this podcast and beyond is like what happens when expectation meets scale? You know, do you think that is an experience that you can perpetuate? Because I've taken some rides that nobody brought me coffee,
Yeah, no, you don't need to get coffee in every ride for it to be that experience. It might be just a really safe ride. It could be overhearing a song that you hadn't heard before and that opening your mind. Or it could be an interesting conversation you had with someone that you wouldn't have cross paths with before. It does not need to be in every ride that you have this world-changing experience. In fact, that would be too much if that was true. But what we have found is that you can scale values and you can scale community. And that's been surprising to see. When we started off, myself and my co-founder Logan would interview every driver that wanted to be part of the Lyft community. And obviously we couldn't scale with that. And so with that, we wondered how could we continue to demonstrate that sense of hospitality in every ride that was happening on the Lyft platform. And we created a mentor program where drivers in other regions throughout the country would be part of that interviewing process, so that any driver getting on the platform was meeting someone else that was part of the community. And those mentors were our highest rated drivers. That was one example of how we were able to scale that sense of community and hospitality.
Is that still happening?
It is.
The mentor part?
Yeah.
Interesting. Talk to us a little bit about Lyft and your lore. I mean, the Valley's so obsessed with founder culture. We hear all about the other guy. But we don't know that much about you and Logan. Yeah. Is that by design? Are you more?
No.
No. You're like, no, I want to be out there all the time.
No, I think, look, we've been really focused on other people, our drivers and passengers. We're incredibly passionate about what we've been working on for 10 years. I met Logan 10 years ago, almost to the day. And he's become my best friend. We're neighbors now. We carpool to work in the morning when we're not taking Lyft, which is pretty crazy and a little bit dorky.
Let's talk numbers, if we can.
Sure.
What data can you give us? How many cities are you in? What's your international presence? And then how would you describe your overall share of the ride-hailing market?
Yeah, so we ended the year last year with over 200 cities, and we've already this year launched 100 new cities within the U.S. We're 100% focused in the United States. Last year, we had over 12 million active passengers and did over 160 million rides on the platform. And we're not going to release any specific market share data, but as I've said for a while now, we've been growing faster than the competition, which means we're taking market share.
So
Who else do you see as your competition? I mean, we've sort of, you know, this tends to get referred to as a two-horse race in some ways. Who else are you looking at?
I'd say it's way bigger than that.
Yeah.
I think the competition is single car occupancy and car ownership. We are a country and a group of cities built around the car. I mean, our major cities are 60, 70, 80% paved. We are using these cars 4% of the time. 96% of the time, the cars are parked. So you have over 250 million cars in the United States parked, taking up a lot of our land that could be used for local businesses, for parks, and could make our quality of life much higher in our cities. And so I think our city infrastructure, the way it's been built, single car occupancy and car ownership is our real competition. And it's on us to provide the best possible experience to our customer in order to convince them that there's a better way.
Is there anything that you guys are doing right this second at this moment in history, back to this idea of the strategic opportunity of biblical proportions? Like, you came out, you know, during Delete Uber at that exact moment with what many people thought was this brilliant PR move, the $1 million ACLU donation. I mean, do you have anything going on right now that you're thinking, all right, this is our moment to get our message out there?
I think it's a combination of many things. There's no specific one silver bullet on, you know, continuing to introduce ourselves to the world. But now that you have growing market share and more people wanting to hear about you, we're here, you know, making sure that people know who we are, what we stand for, and that we're here to take care of our customer.
You're not going to do like Kitten Day?
No Kitten Day. No Kitten Day plans.
All right.
Yeah.
I think you should do Kitten Day, though. I just think you might want to think about it.
Work.
It's like, you're not going to get a chance like this again.
There was one more thing I wanted to hear him say, and that was the word Uber.
Oh, right.
Come
Isn't
on,
that interesting?
Man.
Never says it. I asked them after, I said, is that like a rule? You know, are you guys not allowed to say Uber?
Yeah.
And the communications woman said, it's just him. He just doesn't like to say it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He just doesn't like to say it. And you know, it's funny because you listen to him and you initially think, oh my God. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I came out of that interview. I thought Travis is going to eat his lunch.
Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber. Yeah.
Who, you know, by all accounts is not a like nice person.
We've had him on this program, and we should say, by the way, we've reached out to Travis and to Uber to get him on the podcast. So, but yeah, Travis does not come off as a warm and fuzzy guy like Mr. Zimmer.
He's a hyper hustler, right? And so you listen to John, and you think, I mentally started putting like a little halo emoji after everything he said. Like, I just want our cities to be green, and I want people to be nice to each other. And you think, is this nice guy going to finish last? But then the longer you listen, the more you start thinking, boy, every time he doesn't say their name, that's actually a little bit of shade.
Oh, you think?
It's like they don't even exist to me.
Yeah, but, you know, Uber's got like 80%± in the market.
Yep.
And Lyft has 20%±. And even if he, as he maintains, is actually taking market share, he's got a long road to hoe.
Yeah, but you could also argue that they could sit back and just wait for Uber to implode.
Well, yeah, totally. And the way Uber's going, they could totally do that. Yeah, anyway, I thought it was it. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I, you know, as you can hear, if it were me, I would try to capitalize in some way to remind people that, hey, there's an alternative that maybe nobody knows about, but whatever.
Yeah. Part of what was going on in that interview, like Molly talked about, was a little bit of nice guy shade going on right there. And one of the folks from our digital team here at Marketplace, Tony Wagner, built a thing that chronicles all of Uber's many speed bumps, shall we say, that they've had lately. It's a great interactive, and it'll help you figure out what's going on with the whole Uber-Lyft dynamic.
After this short interlude, John Zimmer will answer our Make Me Smart question with a little halo emoji after it.
Shade! All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they are going to love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, or anybody you care about. What podcast would they really, really like to hear?
All right, you got that person in your head? Now go do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how to download them. Please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. And thanks for spreading the word. All right, I had this one more question for John Zimmer, like we do with everybody that we try to interview on the show, and frankly, sometimes just people who walk in for other shows. It is what we're calling our Make Me Smart question, and it's what is something that you thought you knew, but later you learned you were wrong about?
I'm not sure this is going to make people smart, but I learned that parents aren't superheroes. They're amazing. But as I became a parent, and I know I'm not a superhero and I have many faults, with my baby daughter, I realized my parents weren't superheroes and they were trying to figure things out for the first time when they had me. So that's the realization I've had as I've become a parent.
So wait, you thought they were superheroes and then
I thought they were
like,
superheroes.
They're just
and at
humans.
Times they do appear to be superheroes, and they are incredible and I love my parents and I hope for a little bit of time that, my baby girl thinks of me as a superhero, but I know I'm not.
Aww. By the time she's a grown up, she'll be like, no, you're a superhero.
That's nice. I like that. That's nice.
Oh, bless. I kind of liked it, but I'm not going to lie. I sat there and I was like, I am a damn superhero.
Well, yeah, that's exactly mm-hmm. right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Of course, my first child, you know, he's 18. The bloom is off the rose. My daughter, though, she's 9 going on 10. I'm still the man. You kidding me?
Also, yeah, I don't care what he thinks when he grows up. I am a superhero. You would not believe the stuff I accomplished as a parent. So, I'm owning it. Okay, let's see. We want to get to your emails like we always do. And I have chosen what I think is the email of the week. But I'm going to offer Kai the opportunity to avoid attempting to speak German if you want to take this one first.
All right. No, I will take this one first. It's from right. Mark Dimore or Dimore. Subject line is damn good. Ms. Molly, Mr. Kai. I'm behind my listening thanks to Kai pointing me to Bombshell Podcast, which is a podcast done by Aaron Simpson, a national security woman we've had on Marketplace. But anyway, while making pie dough Sunday morning, Mr. Dimore goes on, I caught up on Make Me Smart, an enlightened interview with a Reddit CEO. I learned mucho to the point of Reddit now being my place to escape Facebook's echo chamber. Fascinating, I thought.
I know.
Reddit is the front page of the internet, which is how they ran themselves. Going on, post-Trump Congress address podcast, colon. Thank you, Harley Davidson, at 800 cubic centimeters, which is part of the whole trade thing. Bravo, keep it coming. Button your coat when you're standing. Damn right you do. That's my personal peccadillo, Kai, speaking here. But I'm so old, you can discount that. No, you can't. See you both tomorrow on Facebook. You guys are a force of nature. Mark. P.S. Molly, you sure you're not from Alaska? That's going to stick. That's going to stick.
It's really going to stick. I mean, it's, you know, I'm from Montana, which is pretty close.
Or so you say.
I knew that about the Bears, too. All right. And the word of the day. All right. So I chose that as the email of the week because I love everything about all the dams and the pie dough. And it's just wonderful. But the word of the day comes from Barry, who sent us a nice email from Germany. He said, I don't know how many listeners you have in Germany, but I'm writing you from Munich. And he wrote a note about normalizing bad behavior, permission, this concept of permission, which we have talked about on the show before. And he said, by the way, the German phrase for making this kind of thinking acceptable is, and okay, apologies in advance, but I think it's probably like salonfähig, 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 salonfähig. I can't wait to get your emails. Please record your proper pronunciations and send them to the show.
Yes, yes.
But he said, loosely translated, that word means you can now say stuff in public that used to be embarrassing. Thanks for a great show, Barry.
That's awesome.
They have a word for that.
All right. A couple more things before we get out of here. Number one is, I alluded to this earlier, we're going to do something involving books and what we're reading and what's good and what's not. So shoot us a note, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want to get us. Let us know what you're reading and why you're reading it.
And why it's making you smarter.
Yeah. And what you're learning from it. Yeah, absolutely.
Book group. Okay. But Kai, what are you reading?
I am reading. This is going to sound.
Don't say Twitter.
No, it's going to sound so pretentious. Oh, my God. I heard on Terry Gross, Fresh Air, a couple of days ago, an interview with an author, Kay Jameson, about her psychological profile of Robert Lowell, the poet.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. He was manic depressive, wrote some of the best poetry this country has ever seen. One of the lines in the book that this woman quotes is, he has written the kind of poetry that will be talked about as long as people are still reading the spoken word or reading the written word. Anyway, so that's what I'm reading.
I like decided I don't want to do book group anymore because I'm going to be embarrassed every time.
No, you won't.
Every time, because I am always going to be reading some pablum. Actually, I'm not reading pablum. I mean, I'm reading sci-fi like I usually am, but it is making me way smarter. I'm reading this book called Change Agent by Daniel Suarez, who I have been actually talking about for years. He writes basically these high-tech science fiction thrillers, and it's always like horrific unintended consequences of technology. The first one he wrote is a book called Demon, which was just amazing, like about how data doesn't track you down. But this one is all about gene editing, and it is so fascinating and so terrifying and so interesting because all the conversations about gene editing are something that I hope to get to on this show. Maybe, I don't know, whenever the news cycle slows down.
Which is like the 14th of never.
But I am learning a lot, and it's super interesting. So tell us what you're reading, and you know, see which side you fall on, either the genius side or the mindless entertainment side.
Tell us anything. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Our website is marketplace.org/makemesmart. Molly's on Twitter at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Tell us what you think.
Please do, and we will talk to you soon. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and senior producer Nancy Fregali. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday, and our theme music is composed in the house by our very own Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Tarnieves. The senior vice president and general manager around these parts is Deborah Glass.